The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Good morning, good afternoon. You're on the Deadline Report here at Fresh FM. This has been Vigil Investigates. And check out my website, which is the Dyslexic Detective, postmanproductions.com. Stalk me on Facebook if you can. Or if you want to support my cause, then go and get in contact with me, care of media, deadlinemediadownunder@gmail.com, and be one of my subscribers where I post out my newsletter to you each particular month. But I also, more importantly, make myself available. So if you've got a story or a link that you want a bit of commentary on, I'm more than happy to comment on it. You're not hiring a private investigator, you're hiring someone that will give you a little bit of feedback and maybe look for a link for you too. So as long as you don't have outrageous expectations, which unfortunately I have had it on one occasion, but most of all the other have been quite happy. But if you do want to get that, basically treat me as an organic AI chat person, then you're more than welcome to do so. I feel that way that you're supporting my cause and I'm giving you something personal and direct back at the same time. Today is the last show we do before Christmas, and I am going to just possibly cover some of the highlights of the things that we've actually looked at during the year, give you some very important facts about my friend Santa Claus. Normally each year we turn around, we do an interview with Santa. He comes in, does a quick pre-show before he jumps out and jumps into his aircraft and, special magical Santa aircraft and flies around the world delivering toys to all the people that actually need them. He's a bit busy this year. He's wanted at the Emmys and the Oscars and so on. So he's just sent me a few important facts to share with you kids about where he's actually up to. We're also going to then turn around and we're going to end with a little, basically half the show is going to be towards the Nelson City Council's coverage of the Waimea water issue. I think this is an extremely important issue. This is, again, one of these things where what we're seeing happen, I talked about this, or we'll be talking about this in shows recently, is that what we're seeing is on social media is that, you know, causes get picked. They get turned up by volume by party system people that want to control the issue so that you're controlling things that they want, they feel the most in control of. And you end up with a lot of causes that they really don't have a lot of power with, but they get to look really good and do lots of kissing babies. Meanwhile, issues which are really important, such as food on the table, pollution, don't really get addressed. And I think water is very much like that. The issue of water privatisation, I feel that both Labor and National are being extremely dishonest. The three waters that ultimately, in the day, the end result of it was a system that was going to provide privatisation through the back door under the pretext of providing it towards Indigenous people, or, you know, succeeding sovereignty rights to them, which I agree with, except what we found is that once they started to spell out the plan, that a lot of the iwis realised that they were actually being suckered into a deal that wasn't really, really good at all, and that favoured certain iwis at the behold of the others. The other version was the National version, which basically they turned around with the slogan of vote for us, we'll change it. But again, the failure which New Zealanders, and it always astonishes me, this, that we don't have this ability to this. Want to slap people sometimes. Change it to what exactly? And no one's ever really turned around and actually, you know, again, really had them on. While we're turning around, see Maureen Pugh and Nick Smith basically busily involved in promoting the idea of public water privatisation for a fund that we told us was going to benefit the wider farmers and the irrigation. But now we're seeing that because of overruns, which were long forecast and predicted by people who said, no, this is a really, really bad idea. We're seeing that basically what's going to end up is the private sector are actually going to be able to control that, and they're going to end up pushing up the costs of the water to everyone else, and while at the same time, under the pretext of sovereignty issues, we're going to see basically land grabs of choice water areas in a way which I don't believe, like the foreshore issue. It was made under the pretext that the Labor government and under Helen Clark took it away from the Māori, from the iwi, the hapū and the whānau, and effectively rendered the Queen's Chain destroyed, and then John Key turned around and probably gave it back to the corporate iwi, which is not the same as the whole thing. And this is the situation I'm seeing, is we really need to wake up to this neoliberal appropriation, where it's on the surface it makes all the right noises, but when you look at it economically, what it's doing is putting the money in the hands of a few people at the expense of us all. So we'll be playing that show at the end, basically, because I think it's an issue which we really need to keep our hands on. And again, when you also ask people to think about when they're looking at things like mining, they also consider how that will affect water, because mining uses a massive amount of water. So when Shane Jones keeps on going on about about the idea of like, oh, we don't need to worry about food. We'll get it from somewhere else. That's just suicide. I've come back from the UK. Nearly 90% of their food is dependent on places like the Cayman Islands and Spain. And if anything serious like happened to them, they are going to be in a dire situation. We are a nation far, far removed away from other land sources. So our food costs we can expect will only increase. And of course, if there's some kind of crisis or basically assault on the supply lines, we would be extremely vulnerable. So this is the dumbest idea. And as again, we see is, you know, Shane Jones seems to think that basically open the door to mining companies that effectively don't have to pay taxes, that effectively have massive costs on our infrastructure, our already groaning Australian infrastructure, is a good idea when they actually only give us back a couple percent of royalties. Don't get me wrong. Everything you're listening to a radio packed full of mineral materials. I've got a phone. I've got a laptop. They're all packed for mining. But the issue is how we choose to do it. And with our own resources, we have the means to actually do this in a way which we can maximize our own resources, effectively keep a lot of that stuff in the ground as collateral and credit for future generations. But no, people like Shane Jones want to plunder while they can. And I think that is a really, really, really bad idea. But let's progress with all these other fun things that we want to talk about, including last week I turned around and I did a show basically looking at this, you know, this thing of my feeling was, you know, what I feel really frustrated about during COVID was that everyone went around and treated like the medical fraternity, like, oh, they're brilliant, doctors are infallible. Well, I've been having, you know, health issues effectively since a fairly serious car accident in the 1990s. And I have to say that the more and more I've actually dealt with the medical system in New Zealand, the more and more I've been really unimpressed by it. And what we're now seeing, I think the figure I saw was 85,000 people can't actually secure specialist figures. And every day you open the newspaper, there are more and more reports basically about a medical system that's failing in its job. And it's failing in its job largely because it's been subject to privatisation and neoliberalism through consecutive national Labour governments for basically the last 30 years. And it follows this model. It's not just happening in New Zealand, but, you know, during the 2016 planning when they knew that COVID was going to, you know, or something like COVID was going to happen, John Pilcher points out on his book, which was reports on the attack on the NHS, is that having known that this major health crisis was going to occur, what did the medical health system do? Oh, it went and slashed 25,000 beds. And it's all around the Western world. There's this model of making the system so corrupt that private enterprise can turn around and say, oh, see, it's not working, and then they can turn around and take it over. But all that ends up happening is that, again, with things like the TPA, is that they end up being a medical system that focuses on medicine, that maximizes the profit of the pharmaceutical and medical fraternity, while not actually addressing the actual causes of the country in concern. So what I was amazed about that show that I did last week, and which was basically saying, oh yes, the rest of the world's finally catching up with what I've been telling anyone for the last 10 years, that our medical system is poked and quite being deliberately done so, was my increase in reader, viewer response was basically up by about 4,000%. I don't think I've actually had a show in the 120 shows that we've done where I've had this much, the feedback has been overwhelming and effectively people going to be, you know, standing in applause. I just wanted to get something off my chest, but it's obviously ringing loud and clear with each other, which is basically the medical system needs to do better and we need to stop worshipping gods as doctors. In fact, I'll add to that point, you know, I can tell you a number of horror stories, first-hand personal directory stories about doctors, which are just showed absolute arrogance and hubris for their clients. And I remember seeing a story about an app which basically wanted to grade doctors on their customer service. And this caused a huge, furore within the medical fraternity. Oh no, how can we have someone? How dare they? Well, I reckon it's way overdue. We also have a situation in New Zealand where any time you want to make a medical complaint, there is no easy process. You have to jump through hoops, and it's deliberately designed so there is no accountable and no transparency. And this is happening all throughout, again, the Western world. We're having this process where the legal system, whether it's the medical, the legal, so on, it's failing. It's set up itself in a way where it's protected itself for so long that now it's good for you guys if you're in those industry, but for the rest of it, the world, it's not fit for purpose. And the results are drastically, I mean, again, my trip overseas in the last 3 months where I've gone around areas which are meant to be, you know, the powerhouses of the Western world, and I'm going around and seeing tent cities where, you know, there's poverty as far as the eye can see. This is not an exception. This is the norm. This is the American dream of corporatism is failing us, and we are really not addressing it. I see so many times I see the woke community, and don't get me wrong, I hate the woke community as much as I hate the woke community. Extremism, two sides of the same wooden nickel. They should both join the Spanish Foreign Intelligence, whose motto is death to intelligence, as far as I'm concerned. But I've seen effectively the woke talk about capitalism and so on, but when it comes down to it, as soon as some corporation comes along and actually provides sponsorship and for this, not just because they actually care, because they don't, it's just as a means of culturally appropriating the mana of that cause, they give those people a gold stamp. The reality is, regardless of what your advertising or packaging is if you're involved in some industry which is basically about maximizing profit so that you're exploiting the people that you say you champion, you've got as much blood money on you as any terrorist out there, as far as I'm actually concerned. So yes, I just wanted to make a mention the fact that yes, that is, I was very overwhelmed and appreciate the response that we got from that show. And yes, we will be following up on that particular point and trying to actually get as much as we can in my own meager way to actually hammer the fact that our medical system needs to be really addressed, and we need to really effectively go back to looking at what Norman Kirk had to say about the whole process, which is basically, you know, people don't really want much. They want a food on their table, they want a roof over their head, they want a system that basically allows them when they need, they're sick, that will treat them, they want a job that gives them some sense of purpose, and ideally they want to be in a relationship with someone that doesn't throw rocks at them. And we need these things. We need that part of socialism, which has been somehow, you know, the activist influences, like, we've fallen into this American trap. You know, it's like, Bernie Sanders didn't get elected for simple reason that he was branded a socialist. And yet we have this, oh no, don't vote for Donald Trump, he's right wing. Oh yeah, we'll vote for left wing while they also support Chevron, Exxon and all the other people blood on their arms. It's about time we started talking about socialism in an adult kind of way. And for me, that doesn't mean going the whole Stalag 13, slying the golden sickle above their hands, but it's about understanding that basically governments do have a social obligation to the people, and there are certain things that should be left in the hands of government, and private enterprise needs to get their sticky little hands off straight away. So in the last, from basically March of this year until now, I've been lucky enough to go to Australia. I've gone to Mexico, I've gone to the United States, I've gone to Europe, and I've gone to Asia. And this has been a really great opportunity for me to kind of go out there and go to these places and check out what's happening politically, activize-wise, music, art-wise, culture-wise, and see, you know, like, a lot of time I laugh because when I was in DC and I was covering the election, and we had this area which probably wasn't much bigger than a, you know, standard football field, and inside it you had every eclectic extremist nut job group you can imagine, Jesus freaks, the lesbian gay land whales, the everybody you can care, the right wing, the KKK. My personal favorite, I have to say, well, my two personal favorites was the Jesus nut, because despite being a Jesus nut, he was actually the only one that was actually making sense, that, you know what, it doesn't matter whether it's Biden or Trump that's in the office, at the end of the day, greed is ruling the roost, and it will continue to do so until we start to address that government isn't about money and resources, is about soul and people's hearts. And I really like that. And I also like the guy that was playing, just playing music, like, all we need is love. He was awesome. But here we have this group of guys all standing in this football field, the cameras all circling around them, they were making an idea like this is what's going on, this is what's happening in Washington DC tonight, when the reality is, outside of that football field, you wouldn't have had a clue that there was anything happening in Washington that night. It was as quiet as it basically as you can imagine. Although in saying that, I did go and first onto, I think it's Gimlet's, a very famous bar, journalist there, bound about 8 o'clock. There's sort of polite sort of interest, but nothing too out of expectations. And then we were seen about 10:15. I was in a bar which is clearly a Democrat bar. Turned out that Donald Trump was going to win the elections, and they just lost it completely. And I left the bar in about 20 minutes because I actually felt scared for myself. And I'm, you know, to be honest, it's not about being left wing or right wing. If I'd been in a right wing bar and Trump had lost, it would have been the same situation. It was just that, but it was the only time I really saw this full on polarization that the media goes on all about it. In fact, most of the time when I was traveling in the States, I found that the split in the post-election there, the split was that a third of the people were voting for Trump, not because they thought they particularly liked him. I didn't find any real, apart from down in Texas, surprise, surprise, any real strong love for Donald Trump. But there was an idea that at least he had some sort of plan, whereas the feeling towards people like, well, actually, you know, telling us that don't vote for big, nasty, orange-haired guy because we don't like him is not really a campaign strategy. A third of people, however, were like, that's why they were voting, and not because they thought Kamala Harris was particularly brilliant. And a third of people were saying, well, actually, they didn't want to vote in elections at all because they thought it didn't matter who got elected. They were going to be voting for basically, it was going to be Coca-Cola and Pepsi that won the elections again, and that America would get involved in more and more wars. There'd be continue to be a situation where the profits rose to the top and the people at the bottom could be expected to get less and less. And from what I've seen in the United States, it was pretty depressing at times. I mean, there were parts of the United States that were actually idyllic, and I went to places like Charlottesville, which were just, you know, out of this world, charm. But wanting, like, through going for the Amtrak through Sacramento, and I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing tent city after tent city after tent city, and that's the people at the bottom of the food chain. Beyond that, what I'm seeing is suburb after suburb, which has no footpath, it's got no community park, it's got no local corner pub, it's got no sense of community. All it's got people commuting into these places where they're actually having to drive quite some far away from their work each morning off the highways into the highways, using gas, creating carbon gases, driving to these little bubbles, closing the door where everything's relied on the television and, you know, again, social media and so on. And that's their community, that's their world. And I think both, actually, to be honest, I thought the tent city people looked like they had something going that I'd rather have actually been involved in. At least it was real. To be honest, I probably didn't want to be, because they didn't look like they were having a great deal of time. And it might be nice in the summertime, but I'm sure their winters were pretty horrible. And again, I saw a lot of poverty in places like Edinburgh, where it's definitely not a good place to be, and cold. But it's what I found also very interesting when I was travelling around was the issues of that. You know, what I found really, actually, I went to a lot of places looking for live music, and I'm sure there is live music out there, and if I'd, you know, known the place, I would have found it, but it wasn't just available. And I found that kind of really, really a shocking sort of thought, because at the end of the day, like, you know, culture is what bonds us as a community. What I'm seeing, what I've seen, with the exception of when I started getting to places like Edinburgh, where, you know, made up for it leaps and bounds, and I'll be back to Edinburgh for sure, was places where there was a real stripping of any sense of actual. It was pretty bland, and that in that way it was, you know, once upon a time I once hearing a story which said that you know, contrary to popular belief, hell is not populated by devils and sulfur with hot, you know, hooves and spiky horns and pitchforks, but rather it's a place full of bland men and with grey suits and clipboards. And I have to say that I sort of really did come away with that particular purpose. Along the terms of the shows that we've covered for the year, we've done pretty damn well. Let's have a look at some of these shows that we've actually covered during the year, or at least, in fact, the via the shipping news, which normally reflects what issues I've actually been covering. So we, again, you know, we did shipping news number 30 was, or in fact, shipping news number 29 was basically looked at my travels throughout Australia. And we had a look at the fact that basically what I was seeing in Australia was that we saw a country that was really preparing itself for war, going to places where, as far as you could see, like the Thales Bushmaster factory up and down there by Bendigo, as far as I could see, basically armored cars being made. I talked to you about the arms expos that were taking place at the time that the Palestinian, the protests against Palestine were taking place, and anyways, the arms exposed, which probably would have got a much bigger news footage, were actually largely drowned out by these protests, which ultimately at the end of the day I don't really think actually achieved a lot for the people of Palestine. And again, I'll be covering this, if I haven't already, in the next week's show on my story called Once Upon a Time, a Hijacked Flag. We've also, of course, covered the whole issue about the gold mining and the mining industry in New Zealand. Again, I would really beg you guys, if you get a chance, to go to my website, The Dyslexic Detective, to go and look at my book section, because the book section has my book, State Secrets, and you'll turn around and see what I have to say about the rise of basically organised crime in New Zealand, which, bear in mind, I can claim my book really resulted in a survey that was conducted by the New Zealand Police in 1999, which identified more than 375 organised crime syndicates operating in New Zealand. And today we see, you know, all these reports about the Comancheros and the Bandidos and Rebels. And really it's just reporting on things that I forecast were going to come to be back at a time when that same corporate media was massively insisting that corporate organised crime didn't exist in New Zealand. New Zealand didn't have corruption. What we now see is that's clearly not true. And as I said, when you go to my book, you'll see that a lot of what I actually report about is how the encouragement of that organised crime is very much linked into the mining industry and the idea about creating a situation where effectively the country is destabilised, and that in turn leads to more and more money being given to the military and the police, which is actually ultimately used at the benefit to basically crack down on those who would oppose things which are economically not fair. And again, you know, again, in my shows in 2024, we looked again about the whole issue of police corruption. We looked at the role of basically the role of why we need more union, especially as we go into this environment of economic disparity. And I've also warned previously about the fact that, as we've now seen in Australia, in my book's previous book, State Secrets, that effectively we need to be careful. The unions needed to really kind of become, what I was basically worried about was how unions can be taken over by organised crime syndicates. And we are seeing that this is becoming a massive problem in Australia. I mean, it's been actually known about since the 1970s with the Painters and Dockers Union, but now we're starting to see it take place in New Zealand. Again, a lot of these sort of activists that get out there that really don't really seem to be that much of the activism scene. They seem to be more in the donate money to my cause and listen to my nonsense. We find that increasingly a lot of these guys, when you look behind who's actually encouraging them, we find very much like strong gang connections. Case in point, as I've often mentioned beforehand, we've got the wonderful Kilwin Alps of Counterspin, who just also happens to have been president of the Iron Thunder motorbike site chapter, which is in actual fact a subsidiary of Hell's Angels. But I'm sure that that's completely unrelated. As they say in the Tui, bullshed, mert. And again, we looked last year, we looked again at the long story again, the whole issue about police corruption, organised crime within New Zealand, and that this is becoming, you know, like, you know, you look at where it is in Mexico, and it's a big deal, and we go, oh no, that won't happen in New Zealand, but we're seeing more and more that actually New Zealand's not actually immune to corruption. And we've been looking very much at the eerie mystery of Alistair Castle and the Scott Watson, Ben Hope, Olivia Smart, which, by the way, got me some very threatening feedback of the, if you don't watch out what you're doing, we're going to put knee bullets in your kneecap kind, which indicates that I must be doing something right. So again, you can visit the stories on my website, thepostmanproductions.org, and we look at the disappearance of William Carey, and we go into the geopolitics of basically gangs and organised crime and police corruption within that particular episode in a very in-depth way, which, for looking at the flack that I got from it, would indicate to me that it was definitely a story that stirred up basically concern in the areas where I would like it to see stirred up concern. Along the way, we've also addressed issues such as the steampunk and art activists Ryu Takahashi of Paper Nautilus. We've interviewed people like David Dunning from The Rockefeller. We've interviewed people like Stephen Love, from who was one of the Waitangi Tribunal, and we also trying to remember the name or Professor Jack Vowles, a wonderful, wonderful guest, constitutional expert, and again we turned around and talked to him about some of the issues about the Treaty of Waitangi. We've had a great year. We've covered lots and lots of issues, and we're taking a little bit of a break right now. And what I'm going to turn around and do is I'm going to go out with Snoopy's Christmas, and then when we're finished playing Snoopy's Christmas, in fact, I think before we go and visit Snoopy's Christmas, there's a couple of things I haven't actually done today, which I just need to correct myself. I said Santa sent me some very important information about Santa Claus, because he couldn't be here to do his annual Santa Claus interview with me. And these are just some of the important things that you need to know about Santa Claus. First of all, he was actually largely created by Coca-Cola, which who also, by the way, actually control the money for most of the nuclear switches in the world, or the Western world anyway, in 1931, and he was depicted more sternly, and there was no standardized look for him. He wasn't red, white. Santa Claus is based on, in fact, the real-life St. Nicholas, and the patron saint of children from Antalya, Turkey. St. Nicholas was known for his generosity. Most of his reindeers are probably female, and we make that deduction because of the fact that female reindeers use their antlers to brush away snow to find food in winter, and that for most of the males have lost their antlers by Christmas. Towards the Night Before Christmas, the Clements Moore poem, A Visit from Santa Nicholas, which is more commonly known as Towards the Night Before Christmas, was first published anonymously in 1823. Now, we've worked out, we've done some, we crunched the number, and basically Santa's informed us that he takes 31 hours to do his deliveries, and that the Santa's sleigh, to do this, it goes at 18 miles per second. He didn't always go down chimneys. The Bathurst was part of his all came from 1812 story called The Knickerbocker History of New York by American author Washington Irving, more famously known for a story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollows. That's the one where the guy loses his head. Now, all it is that you write to Santa do actually go somewhere. They go to a place called St. Claus in Indiana, And when they've looked at all the letters that have come in for Santa Claus, they found that a third of them come from people in America, a second followed by the most people in Canada, and the third are mostly written by children in France. Basically, we've also worked out, we've done the metrics, we got in contact with the AI Intelligence Division and got them to do cargo metrics analysis on Santa Claus's cargo deliveries. He approximately delivers around about 400,000 tons of presents each year, which means that effectively his reindeers are effectively the mutants, because in actual fact you need about 360,000 reindeers to pull that kind of cargo. But hey, this is Santa Claus, and they're special magical reindeers, and they can fold the time consortium timey-wimey thing, as his good friend Doctor Who will tell you. We will have him on the show one day too, Doctor Hill, when he's got time. Boom, boom, see what I did there? Santa Claus does not get stuck in security, have to worry about getting stuck in airport security, because he was actually issued a pilot's license by the US government in 1927, and in 2030 Canada officially gave Santa Claus a citizenship and a passport. The dictator Joseph Stalin decided who really was the Grinch of Christmas, decided to ban Christmas in 1929 because he wanted no region in the new Soviet region to be basically worshipping Christianity, and no Christmas meant no Santa Claus, although people still did it in secret, and they were allowed to do it again in 1990, which is the real meaning of perestroika. And God hope us in the new Cold War that Santa Claus Sonny is not able to fly into the Soviet Union, because there's all those children, just like in the Western world, that want their Christmas presents and they want peace and goodwill to all mankind. And that is an actual fact, the song I'm going to play for you today. It's going to be Snoopy's Christmas. It's our annual Christmas tradition, because it ain't Christmas if you ain't getting the Royal Bandsman Snoopy's treatment, which is, if you go and actually look up the story about the real Charlie Brown and the bomber, and which is an amazing story about humanity, and which is where I think possibly the creator of Snoopy Brown got the idea from. But on that note, here's Snoopy's Peace and Goodwill to All Mankind, and may that be what we get next year. Have a cool Yule and a happy new year, and we'll see you all on the Deadline Report in 2025 with more amazing local and international stories, and many, many good stories and interesting guests, both locally and internationally. It's been a pleasure and an honour to be your host today.
Once more, the Allied command ignored all of its men and called on Snoopy to do it again. Was the night before Christmas, 40 below, when Snoopy went up in search of his foe. Despite the Red Baron, fiercely they fought. With ice on his wings, Snoopy knew he was caught. Christmas bells, those Christmas bells rang up from the land, asking peace of all the world and goodwill to man. The Baron had Snoopy dead in his sights. He reached for the trigger to pull it up tight. Why he didn't shoot, well, we'll never know. Or was it the bells from the village below? Christmas bells, those Christmas bells, ringing through the land, bringing peace to all the world and goodwill to man. The Baron made Snoopy fly to the Rhine and forced him to land behind the enemy lines. Snoopy was certain that this was the end when the Baron cried out,
"Merry Christmas, my friend!"
The Baron then offered a holiday toast, and Snoopy, our hero, saluted his host. And then with a roar, they were both on their way, each knowing they'd meet on some other day.
Christmas bells, those Christmas bells, ring!
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.